Hey, I'm Jonathan Phillips. I'm a postdoc at Harvard University, and today I'm talking with Brent. Brent, do you want to introduce yourself?
Yes, hi, I'm Brent Strickland. Mm-hmm. I am a postdoc at the Jean Nicot Institute in Paris, France.
Cool. So, Brent, today we're going to talk about some of the work that you published recently, and what I think is really, really nice about that work is the way that it shows that some aspects of how we communicate with each other or the sort of language that we use in the structure of our language isn't just sort of an arbitrary set of symbols, but actually seems to reflect in some ways sort of deep things about the way that our minds work. And I think, you know, even cooler, you actually, in some of the ways that you show that is with looking at people that use sign language to communicate. So maybe the best place to start is by talking through the sort of experiments, and then we can get back into why this is such a cool idea.
Yeah, sure. So the thing that I and some of my colleagues, Carlo Garacci, Philippe Schlenker, and Emmanuel Shimla have been looking at is telicity. So telicity is this property that that verbs and predicates have in many natural languages, where some verbs and predicates more generally seem to encode a logical endpoint to the event that they mm-hmm. denote, mm-hmm. while other verbs don't encode a logical endpoint and could sort of continue on logically indefinitely. So you can see this in a contrast in English between a verb like, say, to decide versus to think.
Right.
So if you want to say, so if you say that John, you can say John decided in a minute. That's totally fine in English. But you can't really say John decided for a minute unless John was making multiple decisions over and over again.
Right.
But it couldn't be that. That couldn't right. mean that like right, John right. was like thinking about it and then ultimately made a decision. But on the other hand, for telic verbs like decide, they can take in as a complement, but not for. Mm-hmm. But for atelic verbs like to think, it works the opposite way. So you can say John thought for an hour. That's totally fine. But you can't really say John thought in an hour.
Right.
So in English, you can sort of appreciate the distinction between telic and atelic verbs by the restrictions that telicity places on sort of the complements that the verb can take.
Right.
So that's the thing. So that's the general phenomena that we looked at. And so telicity is this thing that that linguists have been interested in for many years because there's been this suspicion that it might be a linguistic universal. Mm-hmm. But it's sort of tough to nail that argument down because as you look across spoken languages, the way that telicity works is sort of subtly different from language to language. So like in English, there's no overt marking on verbs that say whether or not the verb is telic or atelic. But then in other languages, you do get such overt markings. And there can be subtle differences in the types of complements that they would take. So it's difficult to like come up with a single test to say, okay, for this language, we're 100% sure that it encodes
right.
telicity.
Right, right. And the thought is just so everybody's on the same page, the thought is the reason they're interested in these linguistic universals or these things that are true in every single language is because maybe that will – it's just the idea that it will reveal something sort of deep about the structure of language itself or
– That's it. Yeah, that's exactly right. So the push to understand what's universal in language comes from this more general idea that there might be sort of an innate sort of language module that's common to the human species and what those properties of language that are universal – are a part of that sort of universal model.
Cool. So they thought telicity would be a great sort of test case because it seems to be in a lot of languages, but it wasn't easy to look at.
Right, in spoken language.
In spoken language,
so
right.
So this kind of motivated us to look at telicity in sign language because sign languages have this property that that they often make visible certain things that are not necessarily visible in spoken languages, things that sort of underlying structures to language that mm-hmm. we suspect might be there from sort of subtle analyses of linguistic patterns for spoken languages. You can actually see those things in sign language, mm-hmm. and that was sort of in general why we decided to look at telicity in sign language to begin with. So the way that we did it was that we elicited signs from native signers in three different sign languages, mm-hmm. all of which were historically unrelated. So those sign languages were Italian sign language, sign language of the Netherlands, and Turkish sign language. And they have like they don't have a common ancestor historically. Right, each has sort right. of evolved independently.
And do they look quite different as well? Like if you're seeing, like, would it be easier for me to distinguish that way of signing looks really, really quite different than than the
Yeah, Southern. I mean, they look just as different from one another as, say, like English sounds and from, Turkish sounds from
yeah,
one another.
Yeah. Okay.
So there are going to be maybe slightly more commonalities because of some of the stuff that we're going to talk about later.
Mm-hmm.
But in general, they're just very different from one another. And I guess that is kind of an important point because it's like, I actually found this like really interesting, because this is the first time that I had ever, studied anything in sign language, but that like, it just seems to me there's this like general confusion about sign language where people who don't know anything about it tend to assume that it's like really simple. It's just like, right. It's just gesture and it's not like somehow it's just not
like a real language or something.
It's not a real language. Yeah. And yeah. I ran this study for fun on MTurk and I asked people on MTurk. How many sign languages do you think there are?
Yeah,
I was really surprised. There's hundreds or thousands, and then like and something like 40% of the people said one.
Well, yeah.
So it's like there's a lot of like misconceptions about sign languages,
right.
and also in this like very informal MTurk study, people also tend to say that sign languages were like only like 60% as complex as spoken language, which is just in fact just totally false.
Although, sign languages are just as complex in lots of ways, right?
They're just as complex, and in some cases even more complex than spoken language.
Yeah.
So we wanted to look at Tulicity in these historically unrelated sign languages to ask whether there might be something, some sort of universal property of Tulicity that like kind of shows up mm-hmm. visually in sign languages that you don't necessarily see in spoken languages.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that we did it was that we got native speakers from these different sign languages to create signs for telic verbs and for atelic verbs. So, like in Italian sign language, for example, a telic verb that we used was decide, and that looks like this.
Mm-hmm.
And an atelic verb that we use is to think, which looks like this. Okay.
Yeah.
And so the way the experiment worked. So we did a first experiment because we weren't even sure if people would like be able to sort of interpret these like signs. And also, I guess I should say what the task was.
Yeah.
So the task was we showed these. So we took these signs. And we showed them to people on Amazon's Mechanical Turk, which mm-hmm. is this like you know this big crowdsourcing platform where you can test hundreds of thousands of people,
right.
Most of whom are in the United States.
Yeah.
So we took people from this online platform, Mechanical Turk, and showed them the signs, and we made sure that the people who were responding had no prior experience with any sign language.
Right.
What they would do is they would see a sign. And then they would see two meaning choices, and then their task was to say what's the meaning of the sign.
Right.
So in a very first experiment, what we did is we would show them a sign. So they might see, for example, this, and then the sort of the non-signer on Mechanical Turk would have to choose to say whether does that mean say to decide
mm-hmm.
or does that mean to run.
Right.
So
right.
in this case, we have two meaning choices.
Yeah.
One is the actual meaning of the verb, which mm-hmm. is, and it's also, you know, it's a telic verb. The side is telic.
Right.
And then the counterpart would always be an atelic verb.
Mm-hmm.
That came from a different conceptual domain. So in this case, like decide is a psychological verb, and then to run is like a physical activity.
Yeah.
And we did that really just to maximize the chances of finding an effect. And then we thought, okay, well, if we find something, then we'll go back and sort of make it more fine grained afterwards.
Yeah.
But just to get a rough idea if people could do anything like this at all, this is kind of the first habit.
Right.
And then we found that like people were just like really good at it. So if we showed them this, non-signers robustly would say, yeah, that I really think that means decide, and I don't think that means run.
Yeah. If you ask me, like just right now, like if you're just like this, and then you're like, is that does that mean run or decide? I'm like pretty
obvious, right? and that's what I really love about this experiment is that like you almost don't even need to run the experiments. It just like works as a demo. Like you just you know it's right.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
like. It's, I mean, and in this case, you might say, well, maybe there's just something, like, I expect the sign for run to kind of look like this, so the thing that doesn't look like that, I'm going to think that that's, I'm going to think that that's the...
Yeah,
that's the
or name. You might just think that there's, like, a lot of, like, I don't know, somehow decide is, like, up here, because it's near your head, and it's a psychological thing, whereas running, you expect it to be your whole body motion or something.
Yeah, that's right. I think there are, like, so, like, in this first experiment, there are some, like, there are worries just by nature of the fact that we were using the actual, one of the meaning choices was the actual meaning of the verb. Mm-hmm. Because we also know that sign languages, like, they're, in general, they tend to employ iconic strategies where, like, for example, like, with run, you can actually find signs that, you know, they look like that.
Yeah.
So it's, like, yeah. It's pretty clear that, like, that there's just, like, there's just a visual similarity between
right.
what the sign refers to, the event, the type of event the sign refers to, and the sign itself. So to get around that problem and to ask like whether like any effects that we were finding were like really about toolicity, we ran a second experiment where the two meaning choices that we gave to the participants, neither of those were the actual meaning of the verb.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in experiment three, we showed people the sign decide,
mm-hmm.
and then we gave people two meaning choices. One was telic and one was atelic, so one had a matching toolicity. So the telic one was sell. And the atelic one was negotiate. So mm-hmm. sell and negotiate are very, very similar right. in their meanings.
Yeah.
And then neither of those are the actual meaning of the verb itself. It's just the right. only difference is that one has the same telicity. So sell is telic in the same right. way that decide is telic, but negotiate yeah. is atelic.
Yeah.
And then in that case, we still found that people were choosing sort of the matching telicity. And they do it about mm-hmm. do it about 70% of the time.
Wow.
And it also yeah. works. It also works in the opposite direction, where if you show someone an atelic verb, like say to think,
yeah,
and then we say, does that mean to sell or does that mean to talk?
Right. Somehow where that seems like
somehow people think that means talk as opposed
yeah.
to sell.
Yeah. Right. Because it doesn't have some. Yeah. So do you have a sense for like what you know, like what is it about the sign that helps people make that decision?
Yeah, so the reason, and this is like, this was something that, this is a theory that originally came from Ronnie Wilbur at Purdue University, and I should mention that she deserves, even though she's not an author on this paper, she really deserves a lot of credit for this work, because we would have never ran these studies if it wasn't for her groundbreaking work in linguistics.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's important to make clear that she's really made a huge intellectual contribution in this area.
Mm-hmm.
And then one of the things that she has found in the past and others is that there really seem to be sort of distinct visual patterns that go along with telic versus atelic verbs.
Mm-hmm.
So for telic verbs, what we were saying earlier is that they encode sort of a logical endpoint, or just an endpoint to the event that they denote.
Yeah.
And then what you find in the signs that are telic is that they have what we call a gestural boundary. And a gestural boundary can be something like like a rapid deceleration. So you could have like this, or you could have this,
mm-hmm.
or you could have a rapid change. You could do something like a rapid change in orientation.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, it can be rapid deceleration, contact, or a change in orientation, or a change in handshape.
Mm-hmm.
And then those sort of sudden changes at the end of the gesture, those things seem to demarcate the ends of that gesture, and then that thing gets kind of mapped on iconically to the logically encoded endpoint to the event. That's our view. On the other hand, since atelic events don't encode a logical endpoint, those the naturally occurring signs don't tend to have this gestural boundary. And instead they have there's generally a lot of repetition involved. So you might find something like this, which is a trilled motion, or you might find something like this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It doesn't end like this.
Right.
It seems like at least in Italian sign language, if you do this, you actually convert an atelic verb into a telic verb. But if you just have this by itself, then it just comes off as an atelic verb.
Interesting. You can almost use like your, if you think about that difference and then try to map another thing that you were saying at the beginning about in spoken English, like the cues towards like telicity here. So it seems like it would be really hard to say something like he for an hour. That's like a little bit strange. Where if you said that he and did some sort of repetitive motion for an hour, somehow that like in a very abstract way seems to make more sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Like I think that this actually comes to. I mean, there are a lot of like what's one of the really cool things about this project is that it sort of spawned a lot of new ideas and a lot of new avenues for research. And this is definitely one of the things that we're looking at.
Yeah,
it's like in spoken gesture, we have exactly that same intuition that you would find. Sort of similar traces to similar sort of visual patterns to those that we are finding in sign language.
Yeah.
You could also think that in spoken language, you would actually not in the gestures that you perform, excuse me, while you're speaking, but in the actual speech pattern itself, you could find some analog of this. Hmm. So you could think, for example, so the natural counterpart in spoken language to a gestural boundary would be a stop, something like a p,
duh, or a k. Yeah.
Yeah, or compared to where there like a non-stop where it would be a, something like a fricative, like a z or a s, or something like that. I guess a er would be a would I don't know, but er is not necessarily a fricative. I mean, it doesn't have to be a fricative. It should basically just be stop versus non-stop. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess a er or a l would be another one.
Mm-hmm.
So I've actually been running experiments looking at this where I contrast. I contrast things like razaz, which is doesn't end in a stop but contains repetition,
right,
to a verb like rat. Well, no, actually, rat is a real word, so it has to be a non-word. So road. There we go. Well, no, actually.
But yeah, I think I get
actually,
the idea.
I'll give you some of the actual stimuli. Okay, so here is zazz and zod is a good contrast pair.
Yeah.
But then actually, like the funny thing is, so if you look at zazz versus zod or other sound of equivalents to that, levav versus quat,
mm-hmm.
We don't seem to be getting the same effects, and I'm not really sure why. Like, in some cases, I've run now like maybe three or four experiments, and like I'm finding some trace of the effects,
right?
But it's like it seems like a very very weak effect if there's anything there at all. And I'm not totally convinced that there's actually something there.
The example that came to my mind initially was murmur, which right sounds like something that's sort of repetitive. So like these, I wonder if. You know, even in spoken language, these words that have repeated syllables in them would be more.
But then would be more likely to be ATL. Yeah, but then there's other stuff like I don't know. Take like, let's see, acquire. I mean, that sounds very similar to murmur. There's no repetition, but it doesn't end in a stop. But it's telate. Yeah. There seems to be a lot of like counter whatever rule you come up with. It seems like there seems to be just a lot of counter examples for it.
Yeah. Well, the other thing that I was thinking was that maybe. What's important is that the language has a way of encoding this, right? But not that like it doesn't need sort of multiple ways of encoding this. So if you think that in spoken languages we encode it, sort of like it's encoded in the logical form and like sort of which sort of complements it can take, or something. Then maybe in sign language it's encoded in some sort of separate way. But what's important is that every language sort of has some way of encoding it, and you don't necessarily wouldn't expect it to be. Encoded in.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I think that's totally plausible. But then still a natural question arises, like, so like given that it seems like spoken language has this possibility
mm-hmm.
of, so like, why, in, like in, on our view, what's happening in sign language is that you're getting sort of an iconic encoding at phonological level of the sort of logical form of the verb. You know, the logical form of the verb either does or doesn't encode an endpoint, and you can like see that in the phonology and the visual form of of the sign. And then there's still a natural question that arises, like in spoken language, given that you seem to have logically the possibility of doing the same type of the same type of mapping, why don't you see it in spoken language in the same way that you see it in sign language?
Yeah. So, well, maybe sort of zooming back out, maybe the other thing we could think of is setting that question to one side. Given that we see some way of representing this in the spoken languages, and then this other sort of really nice way of actually showing that's also true in sign languages, what is the fact that we find both those two things in different ways suggest? Like sort of for the bigger picture, if we like return to the question about, you know, is this a linguistic universal? How should we be thinking about what is this showing us?
Well, I think this is something that we've been thinking a lot about, especially if you concentrate on the sort of the sign language results. I feel like there's two possibilities. So, mm-hmm. like one possibility is that the fact that you're finding telicity across all sorts of spoken languages is just tells us something about like a language module. There's just something that's like really specific to how we represent language, and then you know we're finding traces of that like across all of these all of these languages. And that's kind of like the more I guess Chomskyan view of how you would explain this. But there seems to be this other possibility, which is that we have some like really salient. There's really some sort of salient conceptual distinction that we make between different types of events that has nothing to do with language. So, like, you know, in principle, you can maybe find traces of that conceptual distinction in primates who don't speak a language or in preverbal infants. Mm-hmm. And then given the fact that this distinction is sort of salient, it just that's the reason why it pops up in so many languages. And I think that those two possibilities are kind of on the table. And then, like, the way that I interpret, like, these results, I feel like these results in sign language that we recently published are, they're compatible with both theories, but for me, they like, slightly seem to weigh more in favor of that second theory. Mm-hmm. So one possibility is that just in universal grammar, you have some sort of mapping that's sort of stipulated between phonological form on the one hand and logical form on the other.
Yeah.
But the other possibility is that there's just this, like, you know, there's this sort of general conceptual structure. And then we have some general knowledge of principles about how to map that conceptual structure onto phonological form.
Mm-hmm.
And then using our understanding of iconicity and our, like, general sort of conceptual representations, then that sort of generates the sort of universal patterns that we find across sign languages.
Right. So on the one hand, we have this idea that it could just be something super language specific, and the thought is, well, you know, at some point humans had to develop, we're the species that has an incredible ability to communicate. So there's some sort of development that happened, and maybe part of what happened there was some specific sort of arbitrary way of communicating arose, and we're able to sort of just use that to communicate. And the other way is that there's going to be the second view, and the one you're thinking that this research more favors is that there's actually some sort of deeper connection between sort of the way that we're communicating and then the actual the way that we understand the things that we're talking about. So in the case of the telic atelic thing, it's our understanding of the event that some of them have this sort of definite endpoint, like to sell something, and then some of them just don't, to decide something, to think about something. And then we actually just see that reflected in language, and that's why we find it across all of these different languages. Is that the...
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. So I think it's like on the way that I think of it is that there can be for reasons that have kind of nothing to do with language itself, and like that might be apart from a sort of a linguistic module.
Mm-hmm.
There could be reasons that certain types of structures are going to be sort of more intuitive or more mm-hmm. readily learned,
right?
And just like more easily grasped than other types of structures. And there might, and in some cases, though, those intuitions can be so strong that they can sort of attract languages mm-hmm. to take on those patterns in a very robust and very very robust way.
Right. Right.
And I think that's a slightly different story than the one that has typically been told by in the sort of the universal grammar Chomskyan type approach to linguistics.
Right. So one thing that seems really cool about that, the story that you're saying now, is that, you know, setting quite the question about whether or not there's something to universal grammar or Chomskyan linguistics, you could think what this would show us would be that we can actually
And I just want to add one more thing. It's like, I'm not denying that there might be some other things that actually are part of a universal grammar.
Right.
But I'm saying that there's at least a set of stuff that typically we wanted to put in universal grammar that we might no longer want to put into universal grammar. But I'm not denying that there is
Right. So we can say maybe that there is some, that even say that there is some stuff or however you want to decide that debate. One thing that's cool about the approach that you seem to be suggesting is that if we wanted to just do psychology, one way that we could try to figure out which things are easiest for us to understand or seem most intuitive, or which things like are sort of most central to the way that we understand the world, we could actually look at language. But specifically, we could look at the sort of, as you were doing, across a lot of languages, and then ask, well, what are the things that all these languages share, and are they telling us something about psychology, not just about language?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. Like, so I think that, like, in this case, telicity is one example. So I think, like, by nature of the fact that we're finding sort of these universal patterns of telicity, both in, like, sign language mm-hmm. and spoken language, or maybe it's not universal. Maybe it's in 80% of the languages as opposed to 100% of the languages. Okay. That wouldn't really be a big problem for my story. But I think that, like, by nature of the fact that we're finding at least, like, some really large number of languages that encode these things grammatically, that might be sort of a sufficient reason for us to suspect that it's part mm-hmm. of sort of infant core cognition, So then, like, an infant mm-hmm. researcher, like, could actually look at sort of the linguistics research and say, wow, like, there seems to be this thing that occurs, right. like, across all these languages. Now I have this new hypothesis about what infants can actually pick up on if I were to sort of create the right types of stimuli or the right types of displays.
Right.
And I think that and I don't think that, like, Telicity is the only example of this. So, like, there are multiple examples. One is, like, the agent-patient distinction. Mm-hmm. And we can actually see this, like across, like, multiple literatures where very traditionally in the linguistics literature, people have been interested in the agent-patient distinction, mm-hmm. where, like, in English, for example, if you take three sentences, John painted the wall, John kicked the wall, John destroyed the wall. In mm-hmm. all those cases, like, it seems like John is doing, like, the role that John is playing is yeah. very similar, yeah. and the role that the wall is playing is very
right.
similar.
Right.
And so it seems like the grammatical subject is that refers to the person who is, like, carrying out the event.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And intentionally bringing about some state of affairs, whereas the grammatical object is kind of the patient of the event, and then they're somehow undergoing whatever it is that the doer is causing.
Yeah.
So, like, when John is, like, painting the wall, it's like the wall is kind of undergoing that
in some sense.
So, like, that distinction between agent and patient, that seems to be something that you see all over both spoken languages and sign languages.
Mm-hmm.
And the agent-patient distinction seems to map very closely on to the subject-object distinction. Where in general grammatical subjects are going to be associated very closely with mm-hmm. with semantic agents, and mm-hmm. grammatical objects are going to be associated very closely with semantic agents, and then they seem to decide in a lot of languages the order in which actors are going to appear. So it's something like I think it's something like in like 80% of the world's languages, like grammatical subjects will appear prior to grammatical objects, and mm-hmm. then part of the reason for that seems to be that grammatical subjects are associated with this idea of agency. So that's like something that's kind of a mm-hmm. linguistic observation.
Yeah.
But then, in other literatures, we see that in like really these like nonverbal tasks, you can find a similar mm-hmm. distinction. So like from John Truswell's lab, and the person who's been doing this work is Alan Haffrey. They showed that like in a very like in like something like 30 milliseconds, 30 I think it's maybe 37 milliseconds. The human visual system can detect, that's a very specific, very specific number, but the human visual system can actually detect the difference between agents and patients on like very, very short timescales, which is suggestive that that there might be sort of specific routines in visual cognition that are dedicated mm-hmm. towards picking up agents and patients.
Right.
And then you can also find evidence in preverbal infants that preverbal infants are also capable of making the same distinctions. And you get it for, so you can get it for the agent-patient distinction, you can get it for biological gender, which you know also appears as like gender marking in natural mm-hmm. languages.
Yeah.
The animate inanimate distinction, mm-hmm. Which shows up in case marking, and it also shows up in gender systems. There are some gender systems that map on to biological gender, and other gender systems that map on to the animate inanimate distinction.
Right.
I think another example is number. So you can have, mm-hmm. You have a lot, you know, like clearly there's across a lot of languages, there's number marking. So like in all of these cases, we see these like sort of semantic distinctions that show up in the grammar of the languages. And then we can find traces of those semantic distinctions in these nonverbal, sort of contexts with, you know, preverbal infants or primates or, visual processing on very short time spans where it's not plausible that you're actually using language. And I find that connection to be just really to be really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Because initially, one of the questions I had was, you know, it seems like there are these two hypotheses about what's going on, say, with the Telicity stuff you're looking at. And then I was wondering, well, what's really the way? What future experiments could help decide that? And I think one of the cool things is what you're suggesting is that, well, some of the experiments that could help decide that actually aren't linguistic experiments at all. They're just purely psychology experiments. They're experiments, say, with like infants or something. And I think the thought behind it would be that, you know, suppose you started doing the studies with infants and you realized, or non-human primates, or visual psychophysics experiments, and you found that in all these cases, there's sort of some representation of whether or not the event that's happening has a definite endpoint or doesn't. So if mm-hmm. you found across all of those different sort of disciplines and different methods, then in all these cases, Telicity seems to be some sort of really important way in which we distinguish some types of events from the others, then it would seem like it would just seem crazy that then the thought was, well, the thing that's happening in language is totally different, and it's happening for some random arbitrary reason in language, but in all the other cases there's some other explanation. It's like, what you could do is think that there's what we're really doing is sort of this really cognitive science approach, where we're taking sort of these really, really different approaches in different fields, and then what we're doing is, in cases where we find across all these different ways really, really similar things happening, then what we want to do is offer sort of a unified explanation for that thing, and then we don't have to offer a specific explanation for it in linguistics, or in vision research, or in primatology, or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Yeah, I think you'd be sort of like forcing the issue if you're like, okay, well, you know, I want to explain this thing in vision this way, and I want to explain this thing in empathy research in this way, and I want to explain this thing in language in this way. It's just like, you know, it's like the fact that you're finding so much overlap, it sort of cries out for a unified explanation.
Right.
Yeah. And then that's sort of the central motivation for my own personal research.
Cool. I think that's a great point to end on. And I hope we continue on and actually show that that's true.
Cool. Yeah. Great.
Thanks so much for chatting.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
All right.